Thank you for coming. Today's lecture is on King Lear. So, King Lear has its first recorded performance at court on Boxing Day, 1606, St. Stephen's Day, 1606. As we go through the lecture, you'll be able to judge for yourself how suitable it is for festive entertainment. It's published as a quarto in 1608 and in a substantially different version in the folio in 1623. Part of what I'm going to be talking about today is some locations of difference between those two early texts. But the question I'm structuring the lecture around today is just how sad is King Lear? Just how sad is this play? So, as usual, we'll start with a brief synopsis. The play is the story of an aged king of ancient Britain who decides to abdicate and who sets his daughters a rhetorical contest to see which of them loves him most. Inevitably, of course, he picks the bad ones, the flattering ones, the insincere ones, his elder two daughters, Regan and Goneril, and banishes his loyal younger daughter because her declaration of love is brusque and unwelcome. She leaves for France with her new husband, the King of France. The older daughters turn against their father. He's cast off into a storm accompanied by his fool, and he becomes increasingly mad. When Cordelia returns with French armies to reinstate her father, they are reunited, but the battle turns against them, and she is captured and at the end killed, whereupon her father also dies. And this story of filial ingratitude is interwoven with a parallel story in which Edmund, the bastard son of Gloucester, attempts to discredit his half-brother Edgar and the suffering caused to their father, the Earl of Gloucester. He is blinded, quite literally, by Goneril and her husband Cornwall. Edgar disguises himself as Tom of Bedlam to accompany his father, and in the end, Edmund, Goneril, Regan, Lear, Cordelia, Gloucester, and apparently the fool are all dead. So I'm conscious that, as always, this question around which I'm working is an inadequate one. Asking just how sad is King Lear teeters or perhaps tumbles into the banal. But Terry Eagleton's observation on tragedy here is a useful one. In his book Sweet Violence, the title of the book comes from Sidney's Defence of Poetry, Eagleton, in an introductory chapter called A Theory in Ruins, surveys the great critical and philosophical history of attempts to define tragedy, concluding that the only shared, robust definition of tragedy is very sad and sometimes very, very sad. So the critical history of King Lear, I think, circles around this idea and has often been desperate to excavate something positive or optimistic from Shakespeare's play. In the first half of the lecture, I'm going to try and talk about how the critical history approaches this question and tries to rework the play in order to find something positive or optimistic in it. The critical history of the play that I'm going to outline goes broadly in three movements. One, Shakespeare's play is just too cruel. Two, Shakespeare's play is actually quite hopeful at the end. Three, no, it really is cruel, and so is life. So that's the movement of kind of critical history that I'm going to try and amplify now. The earliest responses to King Lear are in the 17th century. As you know, the Restoration period sees a number of Shakespeare's plays restored to the stage, all tidied up to suit the aesthetic and political tastes of the new age. And a version of King Lear is exemplary here as an example of Restoration rewriting. The version is by Nahum Tate, written in 1681. Tate rewrites the play, most notoriously he rewrites Shakespeare's ending, leaving both Lear and Gloucester alive, and the marriage of Cordelia and Edgar as the final culmination of the parallel plots which are implicit in Shakespeare's play. So Shakespeare has Cordelia and Edgar as parallel figures. Nahum Tate kind of takes that to its logical conclusion by having them joined together at the end. Lear's invitation at the end of Tate's play is to pass our short reserves of time in calm reflections on our fortunes past, cheered with relation of the prosperous reign of this celestial pair, the pair being Cordelia and Edgar. When we come at the end of this lecture to think about the ending of Shakespeare's play, we might bear in mind how very, very different Tate's is. Tate's revision is partly a question of aesthetics, but it's also partly about politics. The theme of restoration, the king being reinstated, is clearly a big late 17th century theme. It's easy to see why. But Tate's rewriting is also a response to a play that is too horrible and too comfortless to be enjoyable. The perennial question, why does tragedy give pleasure, a question since Aristotle, has disturbing suggestions of perversity in our enjoyment of misery and becomes even more pressing in relation to King Lear. Tate's answer implicitly is that tragedy does not give pleasure. What gives pleasure is a kind of tragicomedy, which is what he rewrites. We cannot enjoy the play's ending, his revision indicates, and therefore we need to have it altered in order to make it more palatable. And I think we can think of Tate's play as a form of criticism, not least because it's a very explicit example of something that all literary criticism does, to some extent or another. It rewrites its object. Criticism is an act of rewriting, just as revision or adaptation is here in this case. Now, Tate's view of an unbearable ending to Shakespeare's play has its most famous early critical counterpart in Samuel Johnson. In his general introduction to his edition of Shakespeare, published in 1765, Johnson is famously outraged by the ending of King Lear. Shakespeare, he says, has suffered the virtue of Cordelia to perish in a just cause, contrary to the natural ideas of justice, to the hope of the reader, and what is yet more strange, to the faith of the chronicles. And Johnson, therefore, endorses Nahum Tate's adaptation instead. So he's one of very few critics to think that Tate is better than Shakespeare. This is Johnson. A play in which the wicked prosper and the virtuous miscarry may doubtless be good because it is a just representation of the common events of human life. But since all reasonable beings naturally love justice, I cannot easily be persuaded that the observation of justice makes a play worse, or that if other excellencies are equal, the audience will not always rise better pleased from the final triumph of persecuted virtue. So Johnson says, you know, what gives us pleasure is the triumph of persecuted virtue. In the present case, says Johnson, the public has decided. Cordelia from the time of Tate has always retired with victory and felicity. And if my sensations could add anything to the general suffrage, I might relate that I was many years ago, so shocked by Cordelia's death that I know not whether I ever endured to read again the last scenes of the play till I undertook to revise them as an editor. So I was many years ago so shocked by Cordelia's death that I do not know whether I ever endured to read again the last scenes of the play till I undertook to revise them as an editor. So Johnson locates his objection to Lear in the figure of Cordelia, who he imagines to be an entirely innocent victim of an unjust, tragic plot. And he argues that Shakespeare has overstepped the boundaries of something, perhaps audience expectation, perhaps taste, perhaps natural justice. And further, he argues that Tate has reinstated these boundaries. So Tate and Johnson, I'm having as representative of a group of early readers, there are more of them than these two famous examples, who subscribe to the idea that Shakespeare's play is too cruel, it's too difficult, it's too bleak, it's too sad, and therefore it needs amelioration. So the next stage is to outline a shift in that perception, and it's a shift which has a good deal to do with changing attitudes towards suffering in the Romantic period, a new valorisation of suffering, we might think, in the mid-18th century. And that involves a more positive view of King Lear. Let's take one of the romantic critics, the German writer Schlegel. And these romantic critics are all taken from Jonathan Bate's anthology of romantics on Shakespeare, really highly recommended book. Schlegel describes the trajectory of King Lear as a fall from the highest elevation into the deepest abyss of misery, where humanity is stripped of all external and internal advantages and given up a prey to naked helplessness. It's the scale of this decline for Schlegel which is something terrible, terrible in the sense of awful, sublime, and therefore beautiful. By interspersing the story of Gloucester and his sons with Lear and his daughters, Schlegel says, the picture becomes gigantic and fills us with such alarm as we should entertain the idea that the heavenly bodies might one day fall from their appointed orbits. So Schlegel allows that the play is miserable, sad, and as that quotation suggests, that it is even potentially apocalyptic. He partly puts this down to the pre-Christian world in which the play is set. Arguments about why Lear is so miserable sometimes rest on the idea that, of course, it was in that miserable time before Jesus rescued sinful mankind. And that pre-Christian world of ancient Britain you might recognise if you've seen Laurence Olivier's film version, which has the opening division of the kingdoms amid a kind of styrofoam Stonehenge. It may echo the critic G.K. Hunter's rather more subtle description of the play as a Stonehenge of the mind. A Stonehenge of the mind. So Schlegel's explanation of how we understand the play's misery is partly its pre-Christian context, and partly that the play shows us that belief in providence requires a wider range than the dark pilgrimage on earth to be established in its whole extent. A wider range than the dark pilgrimage on earth to be established in its whole extent. So the sense of scale and the sense of the play having an awesome scale which has a terrible beauty is a keynote of romantic reinventions of King Lear. That's the way to understand the play. Rather than being sad, it is big. It's sublime. Coleridge returns to this point in his commentary on the play, which characterises Regan, Goneril and Edmund in a context which at once ties them to contemporary politics and to the nature worship we associate with Romanticism. This is Coleridge now, Shakespeare had read nature too heedfully not to know that courage, intellect and strength of character are the most impressive forms of power, and that to power in itself, without reference to any moral end, an inevitable admiration and complacency appertains, whether it be displayed in the conquests of a Bonaparte or a Tamburlaine, or in the foam and thunder of a cataract. So Coleridge's idea is a completely amoral one, a kind of Nietzschean one in a way. It's about being in love with power itself. Power always is attractive, no matter what its ends. An analogy with the forces of nature also animates Hazlitt's commentary on the play. This is Hazlitt. The mind of Lear is like a tall ship driven about by the winds, buffeted by the furious waves, but that still rides above the storm, having its anchor fixed in the bottom of the sea. Or it is like the sharp rock circled by the eddying whirlpool that foams and beats against it, or like the solid promontory pushed from its basis by the force of an earthquake. So those or clauses, different sort of big scale natural events piled in there. Hazlitt is trying to think about real world analogies for what he sees as the scope and force of King Lear. So natural forces are key to the scale and effect of King Lear in these very quintessentially romantic appreciations. We might see, as you can actually see in romantic rehabilitation of Shakespeare more generally, a kind of microcosm of romantic aesthetic theories, if that's something you're interested in, it's really worth, if you want to understand what Keats or Shelley or Wordsworth or Coleridge or somebody thinks about their own poetry, that they're writing about Shakespeare and their relation to Shakespeare, is often a really clear way to see that. So for the Romantics then, it's the monumental and awesome scale of nature and of King Lear that cannot be constrained by bourgeois social notions of morality or justice. It's an idea which you'll probably recognise as being really the idea of the sublime. That's why the Romantics love the Alps and love, you know, extreme nature. So it's a skip from this to an idea that King Lear could actually endorse some large version of an ultimately ordered universe. That's the skip that Romanticism kind of struggles with about its depiction of nature. Is nature the prime mover, or is there a prime mover behind nature? It's a skip then to the idea that the play actually endorses some large version of an ultimately ordered universe, where critics argue that Lear shows us the workings of a Christian worldview. And this is... For this argument, I'm going to think about two early 20th century critics, A.C. Bradley and G. Wilson Knight. Bradley's essay on King Lear is part of his monumental and influential book, Shakespearean Tragedy, lectures which were delivered during his time as Professor of Poetry in Oxford at the beginning of the 20th century and published in 1904. Bradley argues that the catastrophe, the ending of King Lear, is unlike those of the other mature tragedies because it does not seem at all inevitable. It is not even satisfactorily motived. In fact, it seems expressly designed, he says, to fall suddenly like a bolt from a sky cleared by the vanished storm. So he's still got that kind of nature, unpredictable nature idea there, a bolt from a sky cleared by the vanished storm. Bradley argues that we all want Lear to settle down comfortably, he says, to enjoy peace and happiness by Cordelia's fireside, but that is denied him. And Bradley argues it's denied him because of the play's particular depiction of a wild and monstrous world, and its interrogation of what makes that world so wild and so monstrous. Bradley notices that references to religion or irreligion and to beliefs in general are more frequent in King Lear than in any other play, and also discusses the way in which the play forces on its characters the question, what rules the world? What rules the world? So it's a classic question of agency. What makes things happen in King Lear? Something about that I was talking about in relation to Macbeth in the lecture on that play. The play's final result, Bradley argues, is one in which pity and terror, so we see those to be Aristotelian elements of catharsis, and an Aristotelian framework is really important to Bradley, one in which pity and terror, carried perhaps to the extreme limits of art, are so blended with a sense of law and beauty that we feel at last not depression and much less despair, but a consciousness of greatness in pain and of solemnity in the mystery we cannot fathom. A consciousness of greatness in pain and of a solemnity in the mystery we cannot fathom. So in a reading of the play which has become almost commonplace and therefore critically rather unexamined, Bradley argues that King Lear is not fundamentally sad because it depicts the transformative powers of torment. There is nothing more noble, says Bradley, nothing more noble and beautiful in literature than Shakespeare's exposition of the effect of suffering in reviving the greatness and eliciting the sweetness of Lear's nature. Should we not be at least as near the truth if we called this poem? Bradley has inherited a kind of romantic suspicion of the play as performance, so he uses the word poem as a mark of high praise. Should we not be at least as near the truth if we called this poem The Redemption of King Lear, and declared that the business of the gods with him was neither to torment him nor to teach him a noble anger, but to lead him to attain, through apparently hopeless failure, the very end and aim of life. So this idea that the play should be called The Redemption of King Lear, it's a rather hard won and short-lived redemption, one might think, but to lead him to attain, through apparently a hopeless failure, the very end and aim of life. I'm not sure whether Bradley means that pun on end as both termination and purpose. So that's a view of Lear which owes much to the parallel with the Old Testament book of Job. If you don't know that story, in the book of Job, God tests his faithful servant Job by taking everything he has from him, his family, his wealth, his camels. He sends him boils and casts him into abjection. Despite the discouragement of his friends, the original Job's comforters, Job remains steadfast in faith through this trial. What Bradley cannot entirely account for in this parallel is that what happens at the end of Job's story is that he gets everything back. He gets back his camels, his sons, and his prosperity, twice as much as he had before. The story doesn't seem to say whether he loses the boils, but I suppose he must do. Because Lear's losses are irrevocable, he doesn't get anything back. Okay, so that's where we would think this is a difference, might be worth comparing with Winter's Tale, for example, where Laertes does get things back, things that have been lost. But Lear's losses are irrevocable. His stoicism, therefore, and in Bradley's terms, his spiritual development through suffering, may seem to us rather pointless. But Bradley does consider that Lear dies in an ecstasy, thinking that Cordelia is still alive. We'll come back to that point in a minute. So Bradley then finds a Jobish comfort in the story of Lear, and it's he who has given to us the rather miserable doctrine that through suffering is worthwhile because characters or we ourselves gain self-knowledge and gain in sort of spiritual awareness. Let's look at a different Christian reading of the play, more extendedly elaborated in the work of G. Wilson Knight. Wilson Knight is clearly bonkers, but in some quite interesting ways, I think. So I wouldn't suggest reading him without a sense that he is bonkers. But in a collection of essays called The Wheel of Fire, based on articles written during the 1920s and 30s, Knight discusses King Lear. And for him, the play's suffering is part of a purgatorial progress to self-knowledge, to sincerity. Okay, so Lear's suffering there is purging him towards something better. That's why it's not a miserable play, because it's a terrible journey of purgation which results in self-knowledge. King Lear, says Knight, shows us the spiritual evolution of man. He goes on to say that goodness is the natural goal of man and the aim of evolution. Therefore, at the end, the danger of evildoers in the play is crushed. The good forces, not the evil, win, since good is natural and evil unnatural to human nature. So the good forces, not the evil, win, since good is natural, evil unnatural to human nature. What Wilson Knight can't quite account for is that winning and losing in those terms in this play seem to look actually disturbingly similar. For Wilson Knight, the play emerges as an allegory of redemption through love. Love is its fundamental theme, and death in love brings serenity and tranquility. The play is implicitly Christian because it encourages us to endure life, to turn a stoical eye on its pain and suffering, and to look not for pleasure on earth, but to a life after death. So, Wilson Knight acknowledges the cruelty of the play, but suggests that that's a sign to us that we should look beyond this earthly world to better things elsewhere. And I want to think now about a group of a kind of critical group which is conscious of the cruelty, the kind of existential point about the cruelty of the play, but less secure in a kind of spiritual elsewhere which can redeem that. The 1960s saw a major knock to these attempts to recuperate King Lear as a comforting, just, or even a religiously orthodox play. And important in that are an article by Barbara Everett, The New King Lear, and a book by W.R. Elton, King Lear and the Gods, both in the 1960s, each concluding that attempts to read the play as a parable of meaningful suffering were self-deluding and willful misreadings of a play which actually takes out every opportunity to snuff out our hope and optimism. So I want to develop a sense about the play being deliberately cruel as a feature of late 20th century criticism. So we've gone through, the play is cruel, the play perhaps is more redemptive, and now we're back to a kind of existential cruelty. So firstly, I'm going to think about Jan Kott. Kott was a Polish theatre director whose writing in English, whose writing on Shakespeare, first published in English in 1964 in the book Shakespeare, Our Contemporary, has done much to influence British Shakespearean directors, particularly Peter Brook. We talked a bit about Kott's views on history plays as an endless staircase or an endless succession, cyclical repetition, when thinking about Richard III. Here I want to think about Kott on King Lear, and we can get an idea of the thrust of his chapter by looking at the title. It's called King Lear or Endgame. So it's clearly making a connection between Shakespeare and Beckett, taking an existentialist view of tragedy, showing us the absurdist machinations of a world drained of any providential intent. So in the parallel with Samuel Beckett that Kott develops through his essay, Lear emerges as a Waiting for Godot-type drama in which inevitably Godot never arrives, and where absurdist humour, violence, abjection and grim bonding merely use up the time between the play's opening and its close. Kott argues that the King Lear, which had been so problematic for previous critics and readers and which had required such effortful rereading, has now, in the 1960s, found its moment for the first time. The cruelty of Lear was to the Elizabethans, he says, a contemporary reality and has remained real since. But it is a philosophical cruelty. Neither the romantic nor the naturalistic theatre was able to show that kind of cruelty. Only the new theatre, the theatre of the absurd, can. In this new theatre, there are no characters, and the tragic element has been superseded by the grotesque. The grotesque is more cruel than tragedy. So by realigning the play with the grotesque rather than with the morally charged genre of tragedy, Kott is able to develop his view of a deterministic or mechanistic universe. In the world of the grotesque, he says, downfall cannot be justified by or blamed on the absolute. The absolute is not endowed with any ultimate reasons. It is stronger, and that is all. The absolute is absurd. Kott imagines the play performed in the style of Beckett, Ionesco, and the other mid-century European absurdists. In King Lear, the stage is empty throughout. There is nothing except the cruel earth where man goes on his journey from the cradle to the grave. The theme of King Lear is an inquiry into the meaning of this journey, into the existence or non-existence of heaven or hell. If you just cut through to the end of that, all that remains at the end of this gigantic pantomime is the earth, empty and bleeding. On this earth, through which a tempest has passed, leaving only stones, the king, the fool, the blind man and the madman carry on their distracted dialogue. So for Kott, then, Lear is a play of the European avant-garde theatre of Beckett and Ionesco. It has found its time in its coincidence of values with the existentialist modes of mid-century modernism. And in one last critic I want to talk about, I just want to move that paradigm just slightly forward, just to finish this survey. The last critic I want to talk about is Jonathan Dollimore. Dollimore's book, much reprinted, first printed in 1984, was called Radical Tragedy. So if Cott is bringing Lear forward into the mid-20th century, Dollimore is concerned to specify it in its Renaissance context. His work on Lear insists on the material aspects of a tragedy, which he sees as, above all, a play about power, property and inheritance. Power, property and inheritance. So his play is not at all about suffering, purgation, spiritual development, all that kind of mumbo-jumbo which we've seen. It's not about waterfalls and the sublime. It's about the real world stuff of power, property and inheritance. For Dollimore, the crucial dynamic of the play is property, selfhood attained and destroyed through the possession of property. And in the end, he argues that the play endorses Edmund's scepticism. Men are as the time is. There are no sort of transcendent values. There's nothing beyond that. There's just the kind of pragmatism of this sceptical view. Men are as the time is. Dollimore's critique of the play is also an extended critique of previous criticism of the play for being committed to mystifying philosophical abstraction rather than material realities. He sees the play as less about man or mankind and more about society, less individualistic and more concerned with sort of Marxist interrelations of base and superstructure. So I've spent some time so far on these critical responses to Lear, on a kind of potted history of Lear criticism, to show how the issue of how sad it is has been constructed by critics, and then to try and suggest how these critics are themselves constructed by their historical, cultural and aesthetic biases, just as we are. We get the Lear we want or need by rewriting it through criticism, and although I haven't much time to say anything about it today, also through performance. So a history then of rewriting the play to try and come to terms with its take on the world. Perhaps, though, we are not the only ones doing the rewriting. And in the last bit of the lecture, I want to think about Shakespeare writing and rewriting King Lear. We can see from the sources of Shakespeare's play that he has taken existing versions of the King Lear story by the scruff of the neck, perhaps with the express aim of making the story sadder. So King Lear has historical sources in Holinshed's Chronicles, literary sources in Sidney's Arcadia, and to a lesser extent Spenser's Faerie Queen. There is a previous anonymous play called King Lear, L-E-I-R, probably performed in the early 1590s and printed in 1605, quite possibly the immediate stimulus for Shakespeare to write his play. So there are these written sources, Holinshed's Chronicles and the literary ones. There's also a circulation of gossip in the Jacobean court about an elderly nobleman called Brian Annesley, whose elder daughter, Grace, wants to have him declared senile, so she and her husband can have all his property, and whose younger daughter, significantly called Cordell, strives to resist it and to look after her ailing father. So there are a number of converging stories here, as well as, of course, a kind of Cinderella story, the Ugly Sisters, the struggling or the tested younger daughter, the king's favourite, all that kind of thing. So like many of Shakespeare's works, then, this is an already well-known story. And one of the things that's well-known about it is that it has a happy ending. In Holinshed, the arrival of the French army reinstates Lear to his throne, where he rules for a further 2 years before dying peacefully and being succeeded by Cordelia. The story does darken. Later on in Holinshed, the sons of Goneril and Regan disdain to be under the government of a woman and rebel against her, taking her prisoner, whence she commits suicide with manly courage, rather unlike the Cordelia perhaps we get in Shakespeare. But the shape of the story is quite different. What happens in Holinshed is that Lear is reinstated, that's what's important, and then he's succeeded by Cordelia. Cordelia succeeds her father rather than, as in Shakespeare, predeceasing him. The same is true of that earlier anonymous play, King Lear, Lear, which ends with the old king reinstated to his throne. And so we can start to see that Nahum Tate's 17th century revision, with which I began, has some clear parallels with the sources from which Shakespeare took his own play. We can see Shakespeare rewriting his sources, and in some ways Tate, I think, independently writing them back. So like Dr. Johnson, that's to say, the play's first audiences would have been expecting Cordelia's survival. That's what happens to Cinderella. Her suffering is short-term and she's rewarded in the end. So they would have been expecting Cordelia's survival, if not Lear's, and that therefore they would have been surprised, perhaps even abused, by the play's final twist. It's an interesting take on the play's final tableau when Lear walks in carrying the lifeless body of Cordelia, if we too are bewildered because this is not the way the play is supposed to turn out. Kent's remark, "Is this the promised end?" takes on a kind of meta-theatrical quality. There's more to say, though, about the ending of King Lear as a rewriting not just of Shakespeare's sources, but of Shakespeare's own play. I said at the beginning that King Lear exists in two early and distinct texts, the 1608 quarto and the 1623 folio. Over the last 30 years, Lear has become the test case for the theory that Shakespeare revised his plays. You may think that's a very strange thing to be arguing about. What writer does not revise his or her writing? Nabokov, the author of Lolita, said that his pencils lasted longer than their erasers did. And there's an interview in which Ernest Hemingway says he rewrote the end of Farewell to Arms 39 times. "What was it that had stopped you?" asked the interviewer. "Getting the words right," replied Hemingway. Quite a good argument about why you would do any revising. So getting the words right, in Hemingway's terms, I think is something we can see Shakespeare doing here. When I was thinking about Pericles a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about the ways the first folio has shaped the kinds of questions and the kind of things, the kinds of assumptions we say about Shakespeare. And one of the things the marketing spiel, which prefaces the first folio, has given us is an unwillingness to believe that the godlike Shakespeare wrote in any way like any other person who has also written. Hemings and Condell tell us, as he was a happy imitator of nature, he was a most gentle expresser of it. His mind and hand went together, and what he thought he uttered with that easiness that we have scarce received from him a blot in his papers. So the idea that this just came sort of gushing forth fully formed is one of Ben Jonson's rather nice acidic remarks in his conversations with Drummond, "Would he had blotted 1,000. So that Shakespeare uniquely did not revise his works was held as a tenet of Shakespearean editing until the 1970s. And editors and editorial theorists had offered all kinds of other explanations for why texts existed in discrepant forms. Editions of King Lear before the 1980s typically represented a so-called conflated text, in which the editor picked and chose from the two early versions to produce a text he felt best represented that elusive item, Shakespeare's own manuscript, of course, the one thing we don't have, or one of the many things we don't have. But the idea that the two texts of King Lear represent authorial revision, so a play at different stages of its evolution, but bearing Shakespeare's imprint on it at both points, is now a commonplace. And most critics surmise that the folio text represents Shakespeare's revision, his second thoughts, of the quarto, and that that revision was probably undertaken in 1610. So Folio Lear becomes a play of the Romance period alongside Winter's Tale, Cymbeline and the Tempest, for instance, other plays which are interested in this dynamic of the ruler and his daughter, but which turn that story in a rather different way. Collected editions of Shakespeare since the Oxford edition, first published in 1986, have printed two distinct plays, The History of King Lear, that's the play as it's titled in the quarto, and The Tragedy of King Lear, the play's title in the first folio. Now, I'm not going to get into the bibliography of the differences between the texts, and still less why or how they might have come about. I think where textual issues are interesting, they're interesting as material facts rather than as pieces in a kind of a jigsaw where a broader narrative of how they were, how they've come about can be traced. I think that's a really quite a dangerous or tendentious line to go on. So I wouldn't bother to try and work out why the texts are different, but just to say that they are different, and this is the impact the differences make on a reading of the play. So some of the detail of the differences between the two texts is minor, although it's potentially interesting that in the quarto, Lear promises to express our darker purposes, and in the folio, to express our darker purpose, singular. That's quite a small point, but not an insignificant one. But on a broader scale, it's sometimes been argued that the folio revisions create a bleaker view of the play's events than pertains in the quarto, an idea that Shakespeare rewrites the play to make it sadder in our terms and in Eagleton's. One example of this might be the detail around the torture of Gloucester at the end of Act Three. Having been brutally tortured on stage, where Gloucester's eyes are gouged out by his tormentors, he describes the world as all dark and comfortless, all dark and comfortless. He's thrust out to smell his way to Dover. In the quarto, though, there's an intervening small sequence of about 10 lines at the end of that scene, which shows two unnamed servants preparing to care for the wounded Gloucester. They're going to get him flax and white of eggs to apply to his bleeding face. They pray together, heaven help him. It's a moment of tenderness which seems to suggest that not everyone is indifferent to Gloucester's suffering. It's interesting to think that when the play is revised for the folio, that material is left out. There are no servants and therefore no tenderness. But what I really want to do in the last few minutes of the lecture is to look at the play's ending to see how this idea of authorial revision might have a bearing on our central question about the play's bleakness. There are a number of differences between the ending of the King Lear plays in their two early versions. Only the folio, for instance, has a stage direction indicating that Lear dies. He dies on the line, look there, a line which doesn't appear in the quarto, so a line that's added in the revision. What is Lear looking at? He's been, you'll remember, trying to find signs of life in Cordelia's body. Does he think he sees them? This is Bradley's point, that Lear dies then, like Gloucester does, in a kind of rush of joy. We hear of Gloucester that his heart burst smilingly because Lear believes Cordelia is still alive. And if that's the case, if that's what look here means, if that's what he's looking at and that's why he dies, is that a happier ending? Is it better in literary tragedy or indeed in life to die deluded or comforted? In the quarto, there is no stage direction for Lear's death. He could die willedly. The quarto gives Lear the line, break heart, I prithee break, which could be interpreted as his own renunciation of life, as he realises that although a dog, horse and rat can live, Cordelia cannot. He could die in response to Kent's let him pass, his instruction to Edgar not to intervene, but he could die, in fact, at any point in those last lines of the play. The folio, on the other hand, gives the line, "Break heart, I prithee break," to Kent. It's not entirely sure, it's not entirely clear whether he is referring to himself in anticipation of that ominous journey he cites later as reason he cannot take up office, or whether he's referring to Lear. Another speech, the play's final one, in which it echoes the crisis of speech, truth and flattery with which the play began, is also transposed between speakers. What difference does it make if the play's final moralising couplets are delivered by the Duke of Albany, Lear's son-in-law, and the play's most senior survivor on the one hand, but tainted by his association by being married to the murderous Goneril on the other? Albany is given the speech in the quarto text. But why does Shakespeare revise in the folio to have those lines delivered by Edgar, the survivor of the wronged younger generation, the play's second most significant character by proportion of lines spoken after Lear? So these are places where we can see Shakespeare changing his mind or reworking the play with a particular aim, presumably, in mind. We don't know what the aim was, but we can only deduce it by looking at the changes. And some readings of those changes altogether, put cumulatively, is to make a more miserable, a more sad, a more bleak play. So I've been suggesting that the question of just how sad King Lear is a preoccupation of the play's critical history, that critics have rewritten the play, particularly their interpretation of the ending, in order to support different philosophical glosses on its redemptive or its unmitigated harshness. And I've suggested, I hope, that this is a process that Shakespeare has invited by changing the ending of the story as he found it in his sources, doing his own act of rewriting, but also revising the play in the folio version. So I've tried to indicate some of the ways in which a study of quarto folio revisions might show us a writer at work, revising his work precisely to bring out that bleakness that that criticism has often wanted to explain away. And I've suggested that we might look to the play's conclusion for one particular locus of that work. Thank you.